Well, good morning. We're in the midst of a series. We began a study on the patriarchs. And when we talk about patriarchs, we're talking about the sons of a man named Jacob, about 4,000 years ago or so. Jacob's name was changed by God to Israel. These men, eventually their descendants, their families became large tribes. And so we talk about the 12 tribes of Israel, the Israelites. And so we're sort of looking at a little bit of background history on these folks. We're going to be focusing on two of those sons of Jacob this morning, Naphtali and Zebulun. And I will tell you, Naphtali and Zebulun are not brothers. They're not, that's not in order of when they were born. And so I've used a little different criteria for deciding who to group in this study. And I think I kind of let the scriptures decide who to group. I think you'll see what I mean when we get into it. Our scripture reading this morning was from Isaiah chapter 9. And I think we probably read on verse 2 in our scripture reading. But in verse 1, he said, "There will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish." In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. And so we're going to look at the significance of that this morning. And Isaiah certainly groups Zebulun and Naphtali together, and so we're going to do that this morning. We talked about the fact that it's important for us to study the lives of these men and their descendants and God's dealings with them, because this was physical Israel. This was the chosen people of God. These were the people that the law of Moses was given to. And we are told that if today, if we belong to Christ, then we are Abraham's seed, Abraham's descendants, and heirs according to the promise. And so in a spiritual sense, even though I don't know of anyone in this audience who actually has Jewish lineage, we are all spiritual Israel if we belong to Christ. And that's not an accident. It's not a last minute change God made. That was part of his plan all along, was to use the Israelite people, a chosen nationality of people, as the type for our antitype, to teach us lessons about our relationship to Christ. And we can go back and study the things that were written before time that were written for our learning. And we can apply some of those principles to our lives and be more faithful spiritual Israelites today, if you will. We're going to take a look at the men, first of all, and we're going to take a look at their tribes. And I will tell you, some of these men we know more about. If the scriptures haven't revealed it to us, we don't know anything about them. And the scriptures have revealed more detail about some of these fellows than they had the other ones. So some of these, we won't know a lot about the individual man himself. We'll spend more time looking at some of his descendants and some of the things that they got involved in. As we go through these, we have to talk about how we get from an individual who was maybe the fifth son of Jacob, and how we get to a tribe that bears his name. And of course, we talk about the fact that Jacob had 11 of his sons when he was still working for his father-in-law up in Mesopotamia, married his two wives, two sisters, Leah and Rachel. Their handmaids came along with the deal, and so he ended up with these four women that were bearing these 12 sons for him. He had 11 of those sons before he ever left the household of Laban, his father-in-law. They were heading back down to reunite with his father Isaac, and on their way they came to Bethlehem just about there, and Rachel went into labor, had their child, named him Benjamin, and then she died as a result of complications of the childbirth, and so he lost his beloved wife, Rachel. When we look at the birth of these sons in progression, it's not hard to see some of the evils of polygamy, because here were two sisters married to the same man. It was pretty widely known within the family that Jacob loved Rachel more than he did the older sister, Leah. And because of that, Leah always had a chip on her shoulder. And this childbearing of sons became a competition between the two women. And we can even see that in the names that they chose for their sons. So forever, these young men had to live with this. Forever, their descendants, the tribes that came from them, lived with the names that the mothers of their fathers gave them. And so, you know, Leah named Reuben, behold a son, because God gave her the first one. And we went on down. Each of those names meant something and had something to do with this conflict, this competition between these two women in providing sons for their husbands. Well, we've talked about Reuben losing his birthright because of his immorality with his father's concubine Bilhah. We've looked at Simeon and Levi's loss of their father's confidence because of their bloody, violent retribution on an entire village of men because of the way one young man had treated their little sister. And so the preeminence after the father was gone rested on the fourth son, Judah, with the double portion birthright going to Joseph because of the sin of Reuben. So we talked about Judah. We talked about Dan this morning in our 9 o'clock service and the fact that Dan meant judge. In this study, we're going to talk about Naphtali, who was the other brother of Dan. They were full brothers, had the same mother, Bilhah. But instead of going straight down the line, we're going to jump that. Naphtali is number 6, son of Jacob. We're going to jump down to number 10 and talk about Zebulun in connection with Naphtali. Okay? We don't know a whole lot about these two young men if we're going to talk about the sons of Jacob. The scriptures just don't reveal a lot. The book of Genesis tells us quite a bit about the group of sons, the group of 12, and the fact that at times they were in concert. They agreed. They had the same attitude about things, and they worked together to do things for good or for bad. And so when the scriptures do that, unless the scriptures give us an exception, we just have to assume that the sons that are mentioned all were in agreement and participated in those things. You recall when Joseph was sent out to check on his brothers who were tending their flocks, they saw him coming. They were all jealous of Joseph. And we've observed in the past that this was not a lighthearted rivalry. This was a hatred on their part. They despised him. Many of them wanted him dead. And as they see him coming, they actually begin to talk about things they could do to dispose of this young man that they all dislike so badly. And they probably would have killed him were it not for the words of wisdom from the oldest son, the oldest brother, Reuben, and also son number 4, Judah. Both had words of wisdom to throw in and dissuaded their brothers from actually killing the boy. But no doubt Naphtali and Zebulun were in the mix. They thought it was a good idea to sell Joseph into slavery to these traveling Midianites that were coming through, that were heading south. They were in on the plot to take the coat that they had taken off of Joseph and rip it and put animal's blood on it and take it to their father and say, here we found this, and to lead Jacob into believing that his son had been torn by wild animals and was dead. They shared in the compunction of conscience that all of these men bore for the rest of their lives because of the ill treatment and the unjust treatment that they know they had brought on their brother Joseph. Well, the reason we're going to look at Naphtali and Zebulun is because, not because they're brothers, full brothers, they're half brothers, not because they were next in line to each other in the progression. Really, not even because we know things about the lives the two men lived that connected them. But when you look at their descendants, when you look at the tribes, when you look at where they settled in the promised land, connected them and linked them, they had common enemies that had to be fought. And there was going to be things out in the future that were going to be prophesied about the plan that God had put in place to bring about our redemption that made the region that they settled significant to us. And so the focus in our study this morning is going to be, number one, in their common war with Jabin, who was the king of Canaan, that brought them together, and also the spiritual significance of the region that they settled and that they inhabited in the land of Canaan. Well, Naphtali was the sixth son of Jacob. He was the second son of Bilhah, made him the full brother of Dan that we talked about this morning. Both of them were born to Bilhah and Jacob. But because Rachel, Naphtali wasn't really the natural son of Rachel. He was the son of Rachel given to Jacob as a son through the representative, her handmaid, Bilhah. And so because Rachel was chalking this one up to her credit and they're keeping score, and now Leah has probably five sons already and Rachel doesn't have any. And so Rachel gives her handmaid to Jacob, and Bilhah has Dan and Naphtali. And so Rachel names the boy Naphtali, which meant wrestling. So for the rest of this young man's life, even when he's an old man, his name is wrestling, because his mother said, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and I have indeed prevailed." And so that even if we knew nothing about the will of God and polygamy, this would be, you know, all we have to do is go back and look at the problems it caused for every family I can think of that had multiple wives, and it's just not the way to set up a marriage relationship. And it was certainly a horrible thing in the life of Jacob and his family. "I've wrestled mightily with my sister, and now I have prevailed. I'm going to name this son Wrestling, Naphtali." That's over in Genesis 30 and verse 8. And then Zebulun was not Rachel's son, wasn't Bilhah's son. God had allowed Leah to have more children later, and so Leah has a son again, and she names him Zebulun, which meant exalted. "God has endowed me with a good gift. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons." He doesn't love me like he does Rachel. In fact, I doubt whether he loves me at all, but I've given him six sons. Now God's allowed me to give him six sons. And because of that, God has exalted me in the eyes of my husband. Now he'll love me. How pitiful is that? And so he goes the rest of his life. Not a bad name, but if you look at the history behind it, it's a sad commentary. God has exalted me by giving me more sons to give to my husband. And again, the scriptures really don't tell us a whole lot about Naphtali and Zebulun. They were in on this hatred for Joseph and so forth. And even to the end of their lives, they bore that guilty conscience. When bad times would befall them, the first thing those brothers' minds would go to is that God is dealing out retribution on us because of the sinful way that we treated our brother Joseph. Didn't matter how many years had gone by. After they were reunited with Joseph down in Egypt, and the whole family's living down there and prospering, and finally in his old age, Jacob dies, and the first thing that hits the minds of these boys, these men, is fear. Now our father Jacob's gone. Our brother Joseph is in a powerful position in the Egyptian government. Now that our father's gone, he'll use this opportunity to pay us back. And he had to reassure his brothers, "I mean you no harm. I mean you no ill." They still had a guilty conscience over the way they treated their brother all of their lives. They had to suffer that, and they brought it upon themselves. Naphtali and Dan, even though we talked about Dan this morning, we're talking about Naphtali in this study. Naphtali and Dan were full brothers. They had the same mother. And I will tell you, it was their oldest half-brother, Reuben, who had an illicit relationship with Bilhah, and that was the mother of these two men. And it was known in the family. The father knew it had been committed. Never really let it go. All the way until he was an old man pronouncing blessings and cursings on his son. And so no doubt Naphtali and Dan knew what had happened. And that was drama. That was suffering. That was this turmoil that resulted in this family because of the immorality of that oldest brother. And these young men had to deal with that. Now, we're not told anything about the role that Bilha may have played in it, whether she was a willing participant or otherwise, just don't know. We're not told anything about how these two brothers reacted, but I will tell you, you don't have things like this happen in a family without hurt feelings, you know, without turmoil, without strife that arises because of it, because of immorality. We often bring a lot of our own problems on ourselves because we can't behave, and that was certainly the case with Reuben. We always come back to this chart because it's helpful to see how God decided to organize the descendants of these 12 sons once they become a great nation of perhaps several million people. Moses has led them out of Egyptian slavery. He has led them across the Red Sea, through the wilderness, down to Mount Sinai. And then Moses goes up into the mountain and God converses him with him and gives him the law. And he prescribes the Levitical priesthood and all of the furnishings of the tabernacle. But he also organizes these people by tribes, by who their fathers were. And we noticed over the past couple of weeks or so that to the east was the camp of Judah, to the south was the camp of Reuben, to the west was the camp of Ephraim, and to the north was the camp of Dan. But then some of these other tribes camped on those same directions, and their fighting forces reported in through the leadership of those primary camps. And so on the north side, we had the camp of Dan with his brother Naphtali and their fighting forces serving under the leadership of the leaders of Dan along with Asher. Now, because Judah was preeminent, because every time they would head out and begin to march to a new location that God would lead them to, Judah and Issachar and Zebulun to the east would head out first. Judah leading the way for the rest of the Israelite people with the people of the south. Reuben, Simeon, Gad coming in behind them. The Levites right in the middle with all of the furnishings to the tabernacle. And then behind them would be the camp of Ephraim, including Manasseh and Benjamin. And then finally bringing up the rear was the camp of Dan with Asher and Naphtali. And so we have Zebulun and Naphtali in their positions. And these were arrangements that God made. These weren't things that Moses came up with or Aaron. It was God who prescribed the way the people were to be organized. Now, we look at where these people ended up when they went into the promised land under the leadership of Joshua about 40 or 50 years later. It is very telling, and I think it's interesting, and it is a second reason that we've decided to study Naphtali and Zebulun together. Okay? When you look at the close proximity of the territory that they were given when they had conquered the land, when you look at the location of their region and their territory and the significance in God's overall plan, it's important for us to discuss those things this morning. Reuben and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh settled into territory that they conquered while Moses was still alive. And as long as they assured Moses that they would go over to the west side of the Jordan and help their brethren conquer their land before they went back and settled with their families, Moses was okay with that. But they helped their brethren conquer the rest of the land on the west side of the Jordan, and it was divided up. Judah, Ephraim. Now you'll notice Dan was, if you look at the description that Joshua gave, they're given an apportionment just to the west of Benjamin, down in the middle of the country. But apparently, in our story, as we go through, we're going to find out that just wasn't good enough to suit them. And so they went looking elsewhere. But at this point in time, they're down with Ephraim. When you look up at the top, Zebulun and Naphtali are right there together north of Manasseh. And so they're just to the west of what we now consider the Sea of Galilee. Okay? And that's going to be important to our story. Okay? Well, one of the things that their proximity and the location of their region in the same area together led them to fight the same enemies at times. And one classic case is when Jabin, the king of Canaan, began to dominate the Israelite people and give them a hard time and were oppressing them. And God raised up Deborah as a judge to free them from the oppression of this Canaanite king. And we're told that Jabin was coming out of the city of Hazor, and you'll see that's north of what we consider the Sea of Galilee now. I think it's in red there. And so Jabin in Hazor was giving the Israelite people a lot of trouble. And so Deborah went to Barak, and she said, you need to go to Naphtali and to Zebulun, and you need to get 10,000 soldiers from those two tribes. You need to have them assemble at Kadesh. Now, this is not Kadesh Barnea. This is Kadesh Naphtali, and you can see it on the map there, maybe in black. Some of those letters get pretty small. But this is up in the land of Naphtali. He said, you get those soldiers together, you assemble them down in Kadesh, and I'm going to deliver, God is going to deliver the commander of Jabin's forces, Sisera, into your hands. And you'll be victorious by the power of God, but you need to do it the way God wants you to do. And of course, you may recall Barak said, well, I'll go if you go. And Deborah said, that's fine, I'll go. But then a woman's going to get credit for the victory instead of you if we do that. But Barak and the forces of Naphtali and Zebulun still bore the brunt of these battles. And so he assembles these troops down at Kadesh, but then they go east over to Mount Tabor. Now, the text doesn't tell us why they did that, but maybe it gave them the tactical advantage. They may have been uphill at a higher elevation, may have given them an advantage when Sisera's forces attacked. Sisera came from the east and from the west over at Harosheth, over where the Kishon River was, and they headed to the east in order to attack the forces of Barak, these soldiers from Naphtali and Zebulun. And so we're told that God routed Sisera's forces before Barak and before these warriors from Naphtali and Zebulun. So they drive him back toward the west. Somewhere along the line, Sisera has lost control of his chariot. I don't know if it broke down on him. He had to leave his chariot and go out on foot, and he's on the run. He goes into hiding. The rest of his army is driven on out to Harosheth and the river Kishon, and they are completely defeated. We're told that the king of Jabin is completely, King Jabin of Canaan is completely destroyed. And God has delivered Israel from this oppressive king. But now Sisera is on foot, he's in hiding, and he goes to the tent of Heber and Jael. Now Heber was a Kenite. You may remember from some of our past studies, the Kenites were good friends with the Israelites. Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, was a Kenite. And thereafter, they were often friendly at times. And the Israelites would go into battle, and they would warn the Kenites to get out away from the enemy so they wouldn't be collateral damage. So they were friendly often. But when Sisera goes to the tent of Heber, he thinks he has found friends. And certainly his wife Jael reassures him, come on in, I'll hide you here. Here's some warm milk to drink. I know you're weary from the battle. He goes to sleep and she drives a tent peg through his temple. And that's the end of Sisera and the rest of the forces of Jabin. Okay? So this campaign puts to an end the oppression that this Canaanite king had been bringing on the Israelite people. Now, the scripture gives us, we're not going to read that whole thing. Deborah sings this long song along with maybe other women in the camp. But Deborah sings this song of praise to God for the victory and praise of those who had made sacrifices to bring them the victory. And beginning in verse 18 of Judges chapter 5, we'll look at part of that song she sang. She says, Zebulun was a people who despised their lives even to death, and Naphtali also on the high places of the field. The kings came and fought, then fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach near the waters of Megiddo. They took no plunder in silver. The stars fought from heaven. From their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon. Oh, my soul, march on with strength. Then the horse's hooves beat from the dashing of his valiant steeds. And so she's praising these soldiers from Naphtali and from Zebulun. who had risked their very lives, she said they despised their lives even to the death. They were willing to put their lives on the line. They were willing to put themselves in harm's way for the cause of Jehovah God and to fight for his forces, and God gave them the victory. Now this was the glory days. I have picked out the only passage I could find where Zebulun and Naphtali are really talked about in any meaningful way, other than being just part of the overall people of Israel. This was the only little glimpse of shining glory for these people. Otherwise, they're just sort of stuck off on the corner someplace until we see Isaiah talk about them. Okay? And over in Isaiah chapter 9, we read a little portion of that a minute ago. And yet Isaiah gives us a very significant messianic prophecy. And Zebulun and Naphtali are part of that because of the region that they occupied. Now, if you go over to Isaiah chapter 9, I'm going to jump down to verse 6, and we're going to look at a few statements that are so familiar to most of it because we've heard it over and over all our lives, I think. In Isaiah 9 and verse 6, Isaiah wrote, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace." Have you ever heard those? We hear it at least once a year, right? And if we're good Bible students, we read it more often than that. There's no month out of the year where that statement is more or less significant. It is a powerful passage because it is God's promise 600 years ahead of time that I'm going to send my son, and he's going to be something special. The government's going to rest on his shoulders. He's going to be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. This is clearly a messianic prophecy. There's no doubt about it. But notice how he began that passage. You go back up to verse 1, and here's where he talks about Zebulun and Naphtali. He said, "There will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles." Now, we're beginning to see a little bit of a hint, okay? Isaiah even uses the term Galilee, a term that we're more familiar with. We know where Galilee is. We know what the significance to Messiah was of Galilee. So we begin to see a little bit of that hint. And yet he's talking about the region of Naphtali and Zebulun. When you look at verse 2, "The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them." Well, what in the world happened in the land of Naphtali and Zebulun that would have to do with the coming of the Christ, the Anointed? Well, when you look at two maps side by side, one of those maps represents the lay of the land back in the time of conquest, after Joshua had divided the land up among these 12 tribes of the children of Israel. The map on the right is where that same region looked like in the time of Christ, and it looks a little different politically as far as the borders, the names of the towns, and so forth. But when you look up there at Zebulun and Naphtali, lo and behold, it's exactly the same region as Galilee. Nazareth was in what used to be Zebulun. Cana, where his first miracle was performed, was on the borderline between Zebulun and Naphtali. The Sea of Galilee with Capernaum and Bethsaida and all of that region where Jesus almost set up the headquarters of his earthly ministry, if you will. That's where a lot of his miracles were performed. He did a lot of preaching and teaching in the region. He converted a lot of people. The light was brought to man, and it was broadcast starting from that region, because that's where Jesus was not born, but it's where he was raised. And it doesn't take away from the significance of the city of Bethlehem. But the doubters of Jesus' day would point and say, "Who is this Nazarene? Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? I thought the Son of David was supposed to come out of Bethlehem." Well, they should have gone back and read Isaiah chapter 9. And it's just as part of the prophecy of the coming Messiah was in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali as the city of Bethlehem. And the light was going to emanate from that region, because that's where Messiah was going to do his teaching and his preaching. You begin to see the significance of Isaiah's prophecy when you look at a map like that. He said, "For a child will be born to us, and a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this." Any Jewish scholar of the first century who studied messianic prophecies, who didn't recognize that Messiah was going to have a divine component to his character, was missing something. How in the world did you read Isaiah and not pick up on that? This wasn't just going to be another prophet. This wasn't just going to be a prophet king. This is going to be somebody special. This was going to be Messiah, which in the Hebrew, Messiah meant anointed one. In Greek, Christ meant anointed one. And so you read your Old Testament, you see the word Messiah. You read the New Testament, you see the word Christ, the Greek word Christ. Talking about exactly the same one, the one that the Jewish people had been looking for generations, the anointed one that God was going to bring to rescue his people. Well, that's who he's talking about here. And any Jewish scholar of the day would have known that. Not just talking about a prophet and a king. We're talking about a divine being. We're talking about Almighty God, Almighty Father, Prince of Peace. What do you mean, Prince of who? Prince in what family? He's talking about a member of the Godhead. He's talking about a divine nature of this one who was going to come. This one who's going to be anointed by God, not simply another human king. He was talking about the fulfillment of God's promise to David. You know, he promised David, "I'm going to raise up of your seed, of your descendants, one who's going to reign on your throne forever." And the Apostle Peter talked about it in the first gospel sermon in Acts chapter 2. And said, when David talked about that promise, and he talked about not allowing my soul to remain in Hades or your Holy One to see corruption. He wasn't talking about his own body. He said, David's bones are over here in some sepulcher. We could go look at them today if you want to. As a prophet of God, he was talking about Messiah, the one that was to come. He was talking about resurrection being part of the messianic story. And this same Jesus that you crucified, God has raised from the dead. Those of us who are speaking in languages we've never studied miraculously have seen him, have handled him, have touched him during the 50 days that he spent with us after his resurrection. This is the one, and God has raised him from the dead, and he sat down at the right hand of God. He is fulfilling the promise to David that one of your descendants will reign on your throne forever. You know what Peter's saying in Acts chapter 2? Jesus began to reign when he ascended to heaven 10 days ago, is what he's telling these people. Reigning on David's throne. Some people still looking for his kingdom to come. Wasting their time. He's been here for 2,000 years. Jesus has been reigning on the throne of David just like God promised from the time that he ascended back to the right hand of the Father. And that's exactly what Isaiah is talking about. The anointed one of God is coming. And there'll be no end to the increase of his government. You know, there's no geographic limitations to the kingdom of Christ. We're not talking about it goes from California over to New York or, you know. Some people think Christianity is basically an American religion. It's not. There are no geographic limitations. Has nothing to do with geography. He reigns on the throne of the hearts of men who accepted him, who have become subjects of his kingdom. It doesn't matter what nation they live in. Doesn't matter what generation they lived in. Doesn't matter what their ethnic background is. There is no limitations to that. And every time somebody accepts the truth of the gospel and puts Jesus on the throne of their heart, he begins to reign in their hearts. There is no end. There's no limit to the increase of his government. Not a geographical thing. He reigns in the hearts of men through the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's no end to peace. I'll tell you, I have read Orthodox Jewish websites who will try to explain why they still reject Jesus of Nazareth as having been the Messiah that was promised. And their number one argument is, where's the world peace? Where's the world peace he was supposed to usher in? And they make the same mistake as premillennial Christian so-called Christian teachers. And that is, they think it's some kind of earthly government, earthly reign of Christ on David's throne sitting over in the city of Jerusalem. And where did world peace go to? Not what he ever promised. It's not what he was trying to get across. Not talking about carnal world peace. I'll tell you, when he broke down the middle wall of partition of the sin between me and God, and the middle wall of partition between Jews and Gentiles, no distinction between people on a racial basis anymore, no barrier of sin between man and God anymore. Now we can be reconciled to God. We can be at peace with God again. That's the kind of peace that matters. There's always going to be wars and rumors of wars. As long as human beings are involved, people are going to be fighting over something. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the peace we can have with God. He's talking about the peace that we can have with one another as brothers and sisters, as fellow citizens in his kingdom. He's talking about the peace that we can have with our neighbor across the street if we'll behave ourselves the way he told us to behave. He's talking about the peace of God that surpasses all comprehension. How? If I trust him, if I go to him in prayer and I lay my issues at his feet and I put my confidence and my faith in him and I pray to him and then I get off my knees, I've gotten forgiveness from him. I trust that he's going to act on my behalf and do what's in my best interest and I sleep like a baby. That's the kind of peace he's promised us. And you can't put a dollar figure on it. It's worth 1,000 world pieces. Because you can have peace with God. I can have peace with God. We can be at peace with others around us. And we can enjoy the peace of God that people in the world cannot comprehend. Because God has granted us that. That's amazing. That's true peace. And that's what Isaiah was prophesying. That's why he's the Prince of Peace. And he didn't fail. He succeeded. People that act like he's got to come back and take another stab at it because the Jews rejected him. It's almost blasphemy. Jesus never failed at anything. He did exactly what he came to accomplish. He established his kingdom. He's sitting on David's throne and he's offering me peace and he's offering you peace that people in the world cannot imagine. His kingdom is being upheld with justice and righteousness forever. It's the only kingdom that is upheld by righteousness. Men may strive to be righteous. Earthly kingdoms may strive to do the right thing, but they're never going to get it right. This is the only kingdom that's upheld by true justice and true righteousness, and it's going to be that way forever because Jesus is sitting on David's throne right now. That's Naphtali and Zebulun. That's the reason I put them together is because Isaiah puts them together in God's big scheme of things. And we think of the role of Galilee in God's plan. And where did he send his son? Anywhere in the world. And he chose to put him right there in the middle of the Roman Empire with the Greek language and all of the other things that contributed to him turning the world upside down in 3 years without writing a book. Because of the miracles he performed, because of things that he taught, because the circumstances were right. And it was in Naphtali, it was in Zebulun, it was in Galilee of the Gentiles. And what a wonderful blessing that is. If you're here this morning, you're not a Christian. He did all of that for me, and he did it for you. And he put all of these things in place. The anointed one he sent, he sent not only to become king and reign on David's throne, but to pay the ultimate price. He sent him as the only lamb that's sufficient to pay the price for the sins you've committed and the sins I've committed. You can't pay the price yourself. Nobody can pay the price for you except Jesus Christ, and he was willing to do that. And he died for my sins and for your sins on the cross. And because of that shed blood, God can now justify you. He can say, I forgive this one because he's humbly coming to me on my terms in obedience to what I've told him to do. And when he does that, I can forgive him and nobody can criticize that. Nobody can call me an unjust God. I have the right to forgive him because my son paid the price. That's what he did for us. And because of that, we can have a peace in our lives that people in the world simply cannot relate to. We've been forgiven. You can be forgiven this morning. And then he's given us light That's what started in Galilee of the Gentiles 2,000 years ago. He's given us light. You can read and study the inspired scriptures that he left for us that will tell you how to think and how to live and how to treat your fellow man and how to respond to the difficult things that come your way in this life and the hope that's waiting for you when this life is over so that nothing can get too bad in this life. That's what he wants for you. That's what he's offering you. And I'm going to encourage you to take advantage of it. If you're not a Christian, repent of those past sins. Confess Jesus as Lord of your life. Put him on the throne of your heart. And then be baptized into Christ to put on a relationship. Paul called it being clothed with Christ. That's the way you do it. All of the other steps of conforming with his will are just as important. But if you're not baptized into Christ, you've never put on Christ. You're not part of Christ. You need to do that. You need to become his disciple. Become a citizen in his kingdom this morning. And then spend the rest of your life reading and studying the principles that you can apply to your life and live the kind of life that is exactly what God designed you to live. And your relationships will get better. Everything will get better. There are going to be difficult times, and you can deal with those difficult times because of the hope that he's giving you. He wants to live with you for eternity when this life is over, and that's what he's offering you. And no matter what happens in this life, you can handle it. You can deal with it with his help. For those of us who are Christians, we're here to help each other. We're here to support each other. If there's sin in your life, you can go to God on your own in the privacy of your home, ask for his forgiveness. But if there's something, if it's a public nature or there's something we can do to encourage you in some way and support you, we certainly want to do that. If you just let us know, we'll do everything we can to help. If you're subject to the invitation this morning, come forward and let us know that while we stand together.